We are here to talk about the evangelist, and it's a favorite subject of mine. And if there's confusion around the apostle and the prophet, I think there's confusion around the evangelist too. And we say, well, evangelist, but when you say the word evangelist, name one name that comes to mind. Billy Graham. Everybody says evangelist. Oh yeah, Billy Graham. And here's the thing. There's this. When it comes to pastors, there's every kind of pastor you can think about. Just because someone's a pastor, well, what does that mean? There's lots of different kinds of pastors and lots of different roles and different scopes. You have pastors that pastor 40,000 people and pastors that pastor 40. Are they both pastors? Yeah. They're still both pastors. So the same thing is true with evangelists. So when we talk about evangelists, and we really need to get past the whole Billy Graham thing as the model and the example and begin to look at it in a little broader context, which we're going to today. And here's what we've discovered about, evangelists is that, you've got your large E, fivefold ministry evangelists that could be big or small scope, but you also have people who are small E evangelists, and they're these people that are just gifted and passionate about it, and I'm just as motivated about those people as I am about the fivefold ministry evangelist. And in any given circle, you're going to have about 10% in Christian circles. There's about 10% of your home group, 10% of your church that actually are those people that really have a heart and a burden for that. And so we're going to talk about that as well. But I'm curious about this. How many of you in this room would describe yourselves either as an evangelist, fivefold, or a small E evangelist, just someone who has a burden and a heart and a passion for that? Who are my evangelists in the room? So a good number of you, most of you are, and so that's good. And here's what Paul said to Timothy. He said, Timothy, you'll remember, he was the pastor in the church at Ephesus. That church was planted in Ephesus. It was a very important church in Asia Minor, significant church. It's in a very pagan Greek community. And Paul writes Timothy and says, Timothy, do the work of an evangelist. So he actually wasn't an evangelist, but he told him to do the work of an evangelist. So I think this conversation we're going to have is going to fit everybody, whether you're an evangelist or a pastor or just somebody that has a heart for the lost. I think it's going to work for you. So I'm going to give you, as I said, there are different kinds of evangelists. So I'm going to give you like as many types as there are people. There are that many types of evangelists, but I want to give you kind of three categories and land on one of them. So the three categories of evangelists would be this. They would be crowd, contact, and context. And so the first one, I'm not going to give you too many notes, but I'm going to give you a few things that you want to write down. So those would be the first things. Obviously, the crowd evangelist is pretty clear, pretty obvious what that is. That's someone who can gather a crowd and win people to Christ, like the Billy Graham, like we talked about, and the Reinhard Bonnke's, and the Joel Wells is one of those people that is able to do that. John the Baptist was a crowd evangelist. Jesus was a crowd evangelist. Then other evangelists in Scripture were Philip and Stephen. Again, they had the potential and the ability to gather crowds, which they did. And so there are always those people, but, the reality is for the most of us aren't that. And that's not who we are. And so we're not going to spend very much time on crowd evangelism. And if that's who you are, then, God will help you figure that out. And the second type of evangelist is what I call a contact evangelist. The word that used to be used, it's a terrible word, was confrontational evangelism. And just the whole concept is terrible. And these are people that try to evangelize every single person they ever come in contact with. And so how many of you know those people? How many are one of those people? There are a few of those people. We got one in the whole room. And if they're in a restaurant, that waitress is going to hear the gospel. If they're on a plane, the stewardess is going to hear it. If they're, renting a car, someone's going to hear about it. And I love these people. They're, no offense, they're nutcases. They're a little borderline nutty, right? Because they are just so passionate about it. I love them. I'm not one of them. I'm more in the next category. As we just discovered, most of you are not those people. But to see them in action is a wonder, isn't it? I mean, you think, man, they're the real thing. They are just, I know a few of them, and I'm telling you, they're very effective, and they lead hundreds of people to Christ. But the last category, and this is where I'm hoping most of you land, is what I call the context evangelist. And those are people that in the proper context will share their faith. And so here's what the context might be. When you've developed a relationship with someone, when someone's a family member, when somebody is a friend, when you find yourself in a situation where all of a sudden it's a divine appointment that you have, this context has been created where it's actually quite natural for you to share the gospel. I believe that's the most important. I believe they're all important. I don't want to say it's the most important. But I think for most of us, it's really the key for us. So we had a pastor on staff here. He was 66 years old when we hired him. His name was Bob Masters. Some of you know him. And Dwayne has been on, his son has been on staff here for years. And so Bob Masters came to us, and he would be the most least confrontational evangelist, contact evangelist you'd ever see in your life. But he was a phenomenal context evangelist. And I didn't even know he had it in him, but he had this ability. He led, honest to God, in the 2 years he was with us, he led more people to Christ than any other person, probably the whole staff put together. And the way he did it was he was our visitation pastor. And he would go see people in the hospital, and he virtually led every single person to Christ. And he just did it naturally. And I mean, there's a, what a great context. Someone's sick. You got a captive audience. They can't get out of that bed. Where they, you've come to them. You obviously care enough about them that you visited them. And he led complete strangers. And one of them was my wife over there, Kathy's brother. He was dying at 51 years old. And we had prayed for him, and we'd shared the gospel with him, and we were getting nowhere. Bob says, do you want me to go see your brother-in-law? I said, sure, why not? He goes down there and leads Kathy's brother to Christ after we had worked over this guy for 36 years. And he goes down and in 36 minutes leads her brother to Christ, and a week later he was dead. And we were so grateful that he understood the importance of this and had the ability to do that. And so, you know, I think that's our best option on this. So here's what I'm going to do. When it comes to evangelists, whether you're large E, small E, whether either way, here's what an evangelist does. They do two things. One, they evangelize others. And the fivefold ministry evangelist also equips others to evangelize. Right? Because equipping for the saints with the work of the ministry. So if one is a true evangelist, then they should be able to equip others for the task as well. And so I'm going to give you three keys that I think they're secrets, actually, to evangelism. And it doesn't matter who you are or how you're doing it, whether you're teaching others to do it. I think if you can take these three things, and they're super simple. They're so simple that you might be tempted to just dismiss them. Trust me, it's the absolute key. Here's what they are. They are a burden for the loss, the love for the loss, and a message for the loss. And if you can remember these three things, if you can embody these three things, I'm telling you, you can be transformed into a Bob Masters, or maybe a Billy Graham, but at least a Bob Masters, to be incredibly effective at winning people to Christ. So the first thing is this, it's a burden for the loss. And I think this is a starting place. Without the burden for the lost, you know what? You'll never attempt to win somebody to Christ. And so, you know, I was listening to Jeff Leake this morning talking about Paul the Apostle. And when you read his story, I mean, he was kind of borderline nutcase, right? I mean, nothing stopped him. He got stoned. He wiped himself off. Actually, he didn't go to another city. He went back into the same city. He went back into the city of the people who stoned him. And what was it that motivated this guy? Stoned, beaten, whipped, imprisoned, shipwrecked. Nothing stopped him. And he tells us what it is, and I'll just read it, and you can look it up later. It's Romans chapter 9, verse 1. And it says, I say the truth in Christ. I'm not lying. So he has to tell us that whatever he's going to say, he's not going to lie about it. That's what the young people do these days. I'm not going to lie. My kids say it to me. It drives me crazy. I'm not going to lie. And then they tell me something. I say, why would you lie? Like, why do you have to tell me you're not going to lie this stuff? Anyway, Paul invented that stupid expression. And he says, he says, I tell you the truth, I'm not going to lie. And the reason he's saying that, he's going to say something so extraordinary that you'd be tempted not to believe it. And this is what he says. He says, my conscience also bearing witness in the Holy Spirit that I have great heaviness and continual sorrow in my heart, for I could wish that myself were accursed from Christ for my brethren, my kinsmen according to the flesh. He said, I am so burdened with the souls of my kinsmen, the Jews, that I would prefer to be accursed of Christ so that they might come to Christ. He said, I would be willing to go to hell. That's what he said. If you go read it, you can go study it on your own, Romans chapter 9. He says, I'd be willing to go to hell so that people would get saved. I'm looking at it and I go, I'm not. I'm not willing to do that. I'm not even willing to go to jail for it. I'm not willing to be beaten, imprisoned, shipwrecked. I mean, he's so far ahead of me, it's unbelievable. And how many of you have ever heard of the one-way missionaries? Have any of you ever heard of this group? They're not very well known. I'll tell you why they're not very well known. Because what they did was they prayed. It was about 100 years ago. They would pray. They'd ask God, where do you want to send me? And then they would pack up all their worldly belongings. Are you ready for this? In a coffin. And they'd put them all in a coffin. They'd book a passage on a ship. And they would go to that place never to return. That's why they were called one-way missionaries. And the reason they took their coffin with them was because they were going to die and be buried wherever God sent them. So because they never came home, people, the history of them is not very well recorded because they left and never came back. And they died in that place where they went. And so there's only a few stories that actually ended up being recorded. And one of them was a man by the name of William Milne. And his father was a one-way missionary. And he took his family to New Zealand where they ministered in New Zealand. And eventually his father died in that place. And then when William became of age, he went to the New Hebrides Islands. New Hebrides Islands were cannibals and headhunters, and every missionary who had ever gone before him had died there. And he went there. It was in 1917, and he went there and managed to break through and not getting killed and eaten. And he won tons of people to Christ. 20 years later, 1937, a deranged local killed him. And so he ended up dying in that place. They took the coffin that he very handily brought with him. And they buried him, and they did something they had never done before. They buried him in the very center of town, which they had never done with a foreigner before. And it wasn't a tombstone. They put up a sign, because it's a different culture. They put up a sign over the place they buried him. And it said that when he arrived, there was no light. Now that he is gone, there is no darkness. And he impacted this culture. And so I remember reading that story about this guy that packs up his coffin and goes to die somewhere and brings the gospel and never to return. And then I contrast that with the mentality that people have in the 21st century. And, you know, we had some friends that they were church building another church. They were adding on to this church. And we said, boy, you must be really excited about the fact that you're expanding your church. And they said, no. We said, well, why not? They said, well, we don't want it to grow. We like it the way it is now. And contrast that with Paul, or contrast that with the one-way missionaries. There's something wrong with the church today where they don't have the burden. And I think this whole thing starts with this simple concept of a burden for the lost. So I want to tell you a story of Dwight L. Moody. Dwight L. Moody was, we're talking a little over 100 years ago, considered one of the most effective evangelists in history. And he was doing this meeting one day, and they were in a second story of a building in a busy city. And this young man came up to him and said, Mr. Moody, could you tell me what makes you so effective at evangelism? And he said, yes, I can tell you. And he took him to a window, and he said, look out the window. He says, what do you see? He says, I see people. He said, no, look closer. What do you see? He says, well, I see men and women and children. He says, no, look closer. What do you see? He says, well, I see businessmen, and I see construction workers, and I see school children and little children, and I see working women and mothers. He says, you're still not getting it. He says, you look out the window and you see people. He says, I look out the window and I see people who are lost and going to a godless eternity without Christ. That's the difference between you and me. And Every evangelist that I've ever met that's been truly effective has had this thing called the burden for the lost, where they just cannot contain themselves. They see people as lost. And if there's one thing we have, it would be great for us to restore to the church and for pastors to begin to preach on, is this burden for the lost. Fascinating story. There's a little side note for you, but I'll tell you. So I'm talking about Dwight L. Moody. My grandfather's name was Harley Moody Hughes. My grandfather was named after Dwight L. Moody. And the reason was my great-grandfather was the mayor of Brandon, Manitoba. And his wife was this passionate Christian. And in 1901, my great-grandmother brought in Dwight L. Moody to Brandon, Manitoba, and hosted a crusade with Dwight Moody in Brandon. She underwrote the whole thing personally. It cost her $2,000 in 1901, which would be what? Who knows? Tons of money. It was a huge sum of money. And there was a major revival in Brandon, Manitoba with Dwight L. Moody in 1901. And so then when my grandfather was born, a few years later, they named him after Dwight L. Moody, and his name was Harley Moody Hughes. Interesting story, right? So I always feel like I have a little Dwight in me, little Dwight L. inside of me. So the first thing is the burden for the loss. And let's not ever diminish that. The second thing is the love for the lost. And Jesus said this. He said, they shall know you by your love, right? And here's the way I look at it. You can have all the burden for the lost in the world, but if you don't love them, you're actually not going to be very effective at winning them to Christ. And again, I think this is a bit lost. This whole thing of loving the lost is a bit lost on us. Help me with this one. What is the Great Commission? Go into all the world, make disciples, go preach to all nations. So that's, everybody knows the Great Commission. What's the Great Commandment? Yeah, love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your might, all your soul, and all your strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. And we always look at those two things as mutually exclusive, right? The Great Commission, the Great Commandment. And I believe that they are inextricably connected. That the Great Commission is the what, the Great Commandment is the how. And if we're gonna actually be able to preach to people, we're actually going to have to learn to love them. If we don't love them, I don't think we're going to be very effective. So I got a really super funny story to tell you. And you got time for a funny story? And this one's really funny. And I when we started this church years ago, I mean, really, literally in our first year, I thought we're not going to succeed if we don't evangelize. And there was a program out way back when called Evangelism Explosion. Have any of you ever heard of Evangelism Explosion? A couple of hands in the room. And I only did it once, only tried it once. It worked perfectly. The guy I tried it on literally exploded. And and so it really worked well. And here's what a dope I was. I had never taken the Evangelism Explosion course. I had never taken it, but I got a hold of the curriculum, and I thought I was going to teach it. That's so pastor. You know, I haven't done it myself. I've never done it or never had taken the course, but I'm going to teach others how to do it. And so I got the curriculum, and I advertised it in the church. I had 12 people, exactly 12, signed up for the evangelism course. And I thought, I am so much like Jesus, it's unbelievable. Here I am, I'm going to train these 12 disciples, we're going to go out evangelizing. So I had 5 weeks of material, so I told the group, this is what we're going to do. We're going to meet every Wednesday night. I'm going to teach you and train you. Didn't tell them I'd never done it before. I'm going to teach you and train you for 5 weeks, and then on the 6th week, we're going to go out and we're going to do it. We're going to do a practicum, we're going to go out in the streets, and we're going to do it. Contact evangelism, right, if you got my early point. So anyway, 5 weeks went by. I trained them all this stuff. Didn't know what I was talking about. On week 6, we jumped in vehicles, the 12 of us, and we went, 13 of us, me and my 12 disciples, and we went down to Fort Richmond Mall. Fort Richmond Mall, some of you will know this, was at the end of Pembina Highway, South Winnipeg there. It no longer exists. It's been torn down. I can't help but believe that I had some hand in that. And so we walk into the mall. The mall was always dead. It was always super dead. It was probably the wrong place to go to in the first place. And so we walk into the mall, and I just wonder if you can imagine this picture. So it's me. Think of like a rapper with his entourage. And it's me and my 12 disciples, and we walk into this mall, which is almost completely empty. They're standing behind me. There's one lone man sitting on a bench waiting for his wife, who's probably in a store or something. East Indian man. He's sitting on this bench. So I turned to my disciples and I said, all right, I'll go do the first one. You watch the master at work. I was brimming with confidence. I don't know. I taught myself this course for 5 weeks, so why wouldn't I be able to do it? Now, imagine how stupid this scene looks. You got one lone, poor East Indian man on this bench, and you've got these 12 people walking behind me like this, peering from like, you know, 20 feet away, right? So then this is what I did. I went and I just plunked myself right beside this man. Can I move your hat? Do you mind? He's sitting on the bench. He's minding his own business. And I had my Bible with me because that's how we did it. And I went and I sat down just like this. And I said, excuse me, sir. I have this close to him. And I said, excuse me, sir. I'm wondering if I could share a couple of verses with you from the Bible, particularly the book of Romans, because that's where the good stuff is. And so then I immediately started to read a verse out of the book of Romans. And this guy jumped to his feet. East Indian man, remember? He jumped to his feet. And I'm still sitting there. And he said, get away from me. Get away from you. You silly man, get away. I have my own religion. I don't need yours. Get away. You are a very bad man, Jerry Seinfeld. Now, the Jerry Seinfeld reference wasn't true, but the rest of it was. He yelled his head off at me, and then he walked away, and I'm sitting there, and remember the 12 disciples? They were watching the whole thing like this, and I'm thinking to myself, I'm sitting there and I get up and I'm thinking, how am I going to reclaim this moment? How am I going to restore this? I got to make some lemonade out of this thing. So I thought, just stay calm, stay cool. So I walked over to them and I said, that didn't go quite as well as I hoped. Who wants to go next? And honest to goodness, they said, you know what, Pastor? This was really fun, but I think we're going to go. And not one of them, why would you? Why would you? And they basically got in their cars and went home. And I thought that was like, I remember going home and telling Kathy what happened. And I thought, why didn't that work? Why would it work? Why would it work? What was I thinking? See, here's my question for you. What right did I have to share the gospel with that man? What equity did I have? What relationship had I been? What credibility did I have? Zero. I had no context to share the gospel. I had nothing. I just jumped onto his lap and started telling him about Jesus. It was ridiculously stupid. And I'm imagining that, you know, God, you know, could lead somebody to do that, and it could have been a divine appointment. That's not what that was. It was coercive. It was stupid. It was ridiculous. And it was an utter failure. And I thought, you know, what was really missing was I don't love that man. I mean, I was trying to make a point with my disciples. It was a little illustration that day. And I realized that that's not how this thing is working. When we find Jesus, we have Jesus going about, and I mentioned this the other night, he was a friend of sinners. And he ate with tax collectors. And he loved people like Mary Magdalene. And what was it about him? Jesus went and connected his life to them. And he genuinely and truly cared for those people. And without that peace, without that love for the lost, we're never going to accomplish this journey. And here's the thing that we say, which I think is bogus. You've all heard it. And this is what we say. Love the sinner. Finish it for me. Love the sinner, hate the sin. Really? Is that in the Bible somewhere? It's actually not in the Bible. It actually says, love the sinner, hate your own sin. Doesn't it say something about before you take the speck out of your brother's eye, take the log that's in your own eye out? It does never tells us to hate other people's sin. It tells us to hate our own sin. And we have taken this thing, made this thing. And here's the point I'm trying to make about this. We are better at hating the sin than we are loving the sinner. Right? I mean, if we're really honest, when we look at people and we look at their sinfulness and we look at the way they act, we have a contempt for them. And we sometimes think that they don't really deserve to go to heaven. And we despise them and we have a hard time loving them. And we forget. This is why Paul says to you, do you not remember that you yourself, you weren't in darkness, you were darkness. You were formerly like this. Why does he always remind us of that? He reminds us so we will remember that we were just like them. We were lost and someone loved and cared about us enough to win them to Christ. So this thing about loving the lost is so important instead of hating their sin. Let's just forget about hating their sin for a minute. Let's just love the lost. Let's not worry about their sin. Why would you even think about that? So let me tell you a little story about that. So when we had this ice cream shop called Dutch Made Ice Cream. It was in Osborne Village in Winnipeg here. And when it was closing... And it was when I was a kid and grew up, it was there. And it was closing, and so I thought, I'm going to take my kids down there and go enjoy the ice cream this one last time. Well, Osborne Village is kind of one of those places where, you know, the counterculture people live, the goths live, and the homosexual community. And, you know, you want to go have some fun, you go down to Osborne Village because you got all these strange and wonderful people. And so we went down there, I had my kids, we're standing out there in the street, and we're having an ice cream cone, we're watching the cars and the strange people go by. And this guy approaches us, and I haven't seen him for years, and I recognize him. His name was Jeff McDermott. And I went to high school with him. And when I went to high school with him, Jeff and I used to chase girls together. Neither of us caught them. But we used to chase girls together. But then after high school, he actually went off into the gay lifestyle, which was super surprising for me, and he went off that, and he went that direction. He was now living in Osborne Village amongst the gay community, and I bump into him in the street. I haven't seen him for years, and I said, Jeff, is that you? And he said, yeah, and he recognized me, and so we start chalking. My kids are just standing here licking ice cream like this and not paying any attention, and both of us knew where each other were at. He knew I was the preacher dude from TV, and I knew he had gone into this lifestyle, and I hadn't seen him for all these years. And so this was all the unspoken stuff that we both knew what worlds we were in, and so we didn't really get there. We were just sort of reminiscing. And then he asked me how I was doing, and I said, well, I'm doing great, and we're, you know, pastoring this church in Fort Garry. He grew up a block from here, so he knows exactly where our church is. And so then he says, just out of the blue, he says to me, I guess a guy like me would never be able to come to a church like yours, would it? He was baiting me, you know that. And I said, are you kidding me? If a guy like you wasn't welcome in a church like ours, then nobody is. And I said, you know, Jeff, I know we haven't mentioned this, but I'm going to go there. And I said, your homosexual sin, and that's what it is, it's no different than my heterosexual sin. We're both lost for who we are, and I need Christ as much as you do. And if you can't come to your church, then I can't go to my church, and nobody else can come to my church. I said, we're just a bunch of broken people that need Jesus because we've all messed up in life. And I had this opportunity to connect with him and really talk about what was separating him from Christ, which was this, you know, sinful lifestyle that he had, without condemning him. I'm just putting myself in. We're all sinners, right? We're all there together. So, you know, there I was, rather than being more holy than thou, I just brought myself right to where he lives and says, you and I are the same. We're both broken people. And I was able to share the gospel with him, and he listened. He probably never heard it before in his life. And then at the end of this, and I could see there was something wrong on the shape of his head, he told me he had a brain tumor. He told me he was dying. And a month later, he was dead. And I never led him to Christ that day, but I know it might have been the only time in his life that he heard the gospel. And I don't know what happened, and I'm hoping when I get to heaven, I'm going to see him there because he contemplated those things. I didn't know he was dying. I didn't know he had a month to go. But the big difference was I could have stood there and I could have looked down on him because he was a sinful person, or I could have cared and loved about him because he's a human being, which is what I did that day. And we were friends, and I genuinely did love him. And I remember when he died, just being so broken by that and thinking, I hope to God that he found that place where he came to Christ. And so the first thing is the burden for the loss. The second thing is the love for the loss. And the last thing, and it's just as important as the other two, is a message for the loss. And here's what happens. A lot of times people have a burden, and they even have a love, but they can't get to the point where they actually share the message with the loss. I know this is profoundly simple, but honestly, evangelism is this simple. It's really this simple. So about a year ago, I went to a friend of ours died, and he was an older man. And he was in another church, and I went to his funeral, and I'm listening to the pastor, who's also a friend of mine, and he's preaching the sermon or the funeral, and nowhere in that funeral did he mention the gospel. Never mentioned it. So I went up to him after, and I said, Brad, I said, I noticed you didn't share the gospel in this funeral today, and there was all kinds of non-Christians there. I wasn't criticizing him, I just wanted to know. I said, how come you didn't do that? He said, I never thought of doing that. I said, really? You've never thought of doing that? I said, what opportunities do we get that are better than a funeral when somebody's leaving this world and going to the next? If we don't have a message for the lost in that moment, you know, and he was really stirred by it. And then we did another funeral together a year later. And only this time, I was invited to come and give the gospel. And I gave the gospel. And he says, now I know what you're talking about. And here's my point. You have burden for the lost, love for the lost. We have to have a message for them. And I'm not just talking about from the pulpit in a funeral. I'm talking about in this interaction. At some point, you have to be able to close the deal, right? And so here's what I tell people about a message for the lost. The first thing is this. I think we all have to develop a 3-minute, concise, accurate gospel presentation that you can share in any situation. And it could even be less than 3 minutes. But if we can't explain the gospel to someone in 3 minutes or less, then I don't know if we have a message for the lost. They're not going to listen to you for a half an hour and bumble and mumble away. Why can't we get this concise thing? I can give you mine. I'll give you the condensed version of it. I can give it to you in 30 seconds. And it goes like this. And I use it all the time. And it goes like this. Is that, you know, our first father and mother, whenever that happened, no matter however many thousands or millions of years it was, doesn't matter, ago, they were Adam and Eve, and they fell in the garden, and they committed the original sin. And I know you've heard of that. And we get all bummed out because we think, why would I be condemned for what Adam and Eve did? Well, I got good news for you. We're not punished for what Adam and Eve did. But the bad news is we are punished for our own sin, and we are sinners because we inherited from them a sinful nature. And we all have committed our own sin, and they all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. There are none righteous, no, not one. And then in that little conversation, I challenged people that they are sinners. I said, we all know that. We all know that we're not perfect. We all know we've messed up. We've all made mistakes, and everybody can agree with that. And that's why God sent Jesus into the earth to die for us. And when he died on that cross, he did not die for himself, but he died for our sin. And then you quote John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that who should ever believe in him should not perish but have everlasting life. That took 2 minutes, maybe. That's the presentation, and there are different ways of doing it, but I think something concise and simple. So the first thing, you have to have a message for the lost, something that is, you know, simple and concise. That's the first part. Second thing that you can do that I tell people is super helpful is tell your own story. You know, your own story. See, people have objections. Well, why is there evil in the world? Like, why does God let people starve? Why are we destroying the environment? Or whatever, you know. Or I don't believe that. I think the earth is 100 million years old. You don't even get into that. You can't answer all those questions. You're not going to win that. What you do is you tell your own story because nobody has an objection to your story. There's no rebuttal. They're going to say, that's not right. Yeah, it is right. It's my story. This is what happened in my life. And your story, your testimony, and again, don't make it half an hour long, your testimony is immensely powerful. And then the last piece of this is that you need at some point to close the deal. You have to be able to close the deal, and you have to be able to some way ask them. You have to have a way of inviting them. And every situation is a little different, right? So you have to have a way of inviting them into that conversation or prayer. So the different settings have different approaches to that. But I think the invitation is super important to say, would you like to pray? And if you're visiting someone in the hospital, you say, would you like to pray right now and invite Jesus into your heart? It'd be really simple. I can lead you in that. And I know you don't know how to pray, but I can show you and I can say the words and you can repeat after me. And that's why we do this thing in the church. And how many of you are pastors? A bunch of you are pastors. And so I just want to talk to you for a second here. One of the things we do in this church is we give an invitation every single service. And I don't care if there's no non-Christians there or not. I do it anyway. Because what if there is? And you don't always know that. And sometimes you'll be surprised. I've heard stories of people who've had leaders in their church get saved when they did an invitation. And, you know, the altar call, we always think that it needs to look like the Billy Graham thing. And that whole altar call, you know, come to the front, that whole thing. Do you know that for 1,800 years of Christianity, there was no such thing as an altar call? It never happened. There's no examples of that in history. And if you look back at the people, I'm just winding it down with these thoughts. If you look back at the people, Charles Spurgeon, for example, who was on the other side of the pond and was tremendously effective winning people to Christ, thousands of people came to Christ, never took an altar call. And what he did, he would tell people to call on the name of the Lord right where they are, right now. And this is how he'd say it. He'd say, don't stir an inch. He said, don't leave this place until you've made that commitment. So he never called people forward. He just challenged them right where they were sitting in this big auditorium at the Metropolitan Church in London. And all kinds of people saved. On the other side of the ocean, there was Charles Finney, who lived around the same time. He's one of the most effective evangelists in human history, actually, with a retention rate of about 95% of people who got saved stayed saved. And he would go into cities, and almost every single person would get saved. And there's lots of stories around that. And here's what he did. He refused to give an invitation while the people were in the room. And he said, if you want to come to Christ, you can come back this afternoon and in the hall. And if the conviction is still on you, then you can get saved. So he'd send people home and make them come back 2 hours later. And so he called that the inquirer's room. And so he'd invite them to the inquirer service, and then they would ask questions and different stuff, and that's how he did it. And then he realized he probably didn't need to send them home and have them come back, and he thought, I can probably... And he set up these benches called the anxious bench. And they would have these benches, and he'd say, come sit on the anxious bench and wrestle with God. And so this is where the whole altar call thing started to happen. And so then the people would come, they would sit on the anxious bench and get anxious and come to Christ. Remember old words and whatever. And so then that's where the whole altar call started to come from, because now he was beginning to call them forward. And then by the time Dwight L. Moody came along that I mentioned earlier, he was in the full-blown altar call. And he was the one that did it and called people forward. And that's why 20th century evangelists like Billy Graham and others, and Billy Sunday and different people like that, that whole concept of calling people forward. But I don't think that's very important. I think that's something that was fine. It worked for them. It worked in crusades. I don't think it's fantastic. I've had people say, Pastor Mark, you're not doing the altar call right. You need to have people come to the front and kneel down and confess of their sin. And I said, well, why don't you come down and kneel and confess your sin first and show us how it's worked, and then maybe we'll take it from there. And right, why would you ask a non-Christian to do that? And you come down, you miserable. So I think what's important is that we just So we don't use the term altar call. We use the word invitation. And I think what's important is to make an invitation for people to come to Christ. So in our setting, for 25 years, and there's a backstory to this that I don't have time to get into, but we've been doing invitations for 25 years in this church. And in 25 years, every single Sunday for 25 years, we have never had a single Sunday in 25 years where at least one person did not come to Christ. And usually it's multiple people. And we've seen thousands and thousands of people come to Christ just because we go through this process of trying to close the deal and giving them an opportunity. And in our settings, this is what we do, is we have you've probably seen it in the sanctuary, there's a table called Discovery. There's a banner there, have you seen it? So we ask people, show of hands, every head bowed, every eye closed. You can do it however you want, but this is what we do. Every head bowed, every eye closed, every service we do this, every service. And usually people don't get this saved the first week. They've seen this a few times and they go, oh, okay, so I know what I'm supposed to do. And then finally they get it. So they put up their hand. I say, thank you. You put down their hand. I don't necessarily see everybody's hand. Lead the whole congregation in the prayer. We, as Kathy, my wife, says, we all get saved every single week. I say, just making sure. And then we invite people to go to the discovery table. And we give them a Bible and we give them a copy of my book and they tell them about, and then we put them, then we invite them to a course. The course is called the Discovery Course, and it's a 4-week course that teaches them the simple basics of Christianity. And we put them on a process. See, for me, the invitation is the start of the journey, not the finish. That's all it is. All right. Tons more I could talk about this. We have a couple of minutes only for any sort of quick questions or thoughts on this, and then we'll go for lunch. Boy, I'm that good. Wow, great. You want lunch. Father, we thank you. I want to pray for you. I thank you, Father, that there's a room full of evangelists here. Small e, large e. And I pray that in the name of Jesus, you would give them these three things. A burden for the lost, a love for the lost, and a message for the lost. In Jesus' name. Amen. God bless. I'm around if you have questions.